anywhere in the human body, if the bone is formed, right, is that it's all about knowing the details of anatomy of that bone and the details of how it got that way. Right? It's the history of its anatomy, how it is formed and in what directions and with what other structures at what times. And all of that then becomes the difference in treating one part or another part or any part. Right? To the extent that you know the details of the anatomy development in any place, the principles are the same. The way in which you use your hands and the way in which you interact with those tissues is the same. Let's take an example so that doesn't sound so vague. Let's take a simple example. Forget about intraosseous compressions, right? Where you will be usually following the compression forces within the one bone until you sense a response in the tissues, at which point you start working with that response in whatever direction or combination of directions it expresses. Yeah. Okay. But let's take a simpler example. Simplest of all manual cranial techniques, right? The V-spread. You might say, okay, well, if I were to... This came up just this week when we asked Dr. Miller ourselves, how do you treat cranial synostosis? This horrible situation that some children get when the sutures come together too soon and begin to fuse and the fontanelle closes much too soon. Can we confidently encourage these parents to put off surgery and do something about this in your experience? Well, Dr. Miller said, in my experience, most cases of cranial synostosis respond beautifully to this kind of treatment, especially the very first treatment. If you really treat them thoroughly, sometimes you'll notice a big increase in head circumference. So you measure it before, just to give the parents some hope. You measure it before your first treatment, and you show them the tape. You go labella to ilion very carefully with the tape, and you measure it after. And at the next visit, because it can take some time in between a visit. And what do you notice typically on often? You said that...
Well, most of the ones that are microcephalics that they bring in, you know...
So those are less good, isn't it?
Well, cranial stenosis can be a form of microcephalic. Depending on what the situation is.
You say the normal cephalic, early closing fontanelle, bends to a surgeon, and told the kid has cranial stenosis and might need a reconstructive surgery.
Well, most of those are really just the microcephaly. So when you treat the microcephaly and get those sutures open, synostosis is coming. But again, well, the true microcephaly is genetically. Yeah, you've got a small brain inside. So if you really don't have the pressure of growth inside, push the joints up.
Yeah.
Right, they're not going to grow. They're going to be, that's an abnormality that's not going to short.
Right. But you're talking about microcephaly.
Yeah. Well, these kids may have an inch and a half to 2 inches below the normal cephalic index, but they should have on the circumference. And I've had them inside whenever you treat them, they expand as much as an inch and a half following the first treatment.
The same day.
Same day, within an hour.
Within an hour. You get that?
So, there you measure before and after that first treatment, and that can be all the evidence the family needs to give a very fair trial to osteopathic treatment. Now, I asked Dr. I'm sorry, Dr. Fryman.
We are adding not just circumference, but the bifungal, bifurial, and occipitofungal dimensions. And when you have a very narrow frontal, they're wider triangles, so the frontals get wider. wider. The varietals may stay the same or radical change, but the occipitofrontal may catch on, which means that you're changing an extension type head into more of a flexion type head. And I would strongly recommend that you get a pair of these small calipers that in which you can do that. I'd like to have a real series of patients with records like that, because then we would have something of real significance to publish.
There you go, our first multi-center trial. Okay? Everyone here is a participant in the study. Get yourself some calipers. Measure pterion to pterion, asterion to asterion, or is that correct?
It's no. The parietal boss.
Parietal boss.
The widest,
the widest part of the posterior vault, the widest part of the anterior vault, and the longest AP diameter, which will be somewhere on the frontal to somewhere on the occiput. Is that correct, Dr. Fine? We want the widest possible caliper measurements.
Because you've got the change between the strongly extension type and the more of a flexion type.
Viola, do you use Bregma or Nasion anterior?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't got a long pair of calipers yet. But they have made one for this purpose. And so it's really from the most prominent part of the metatarsal area. So long as you measure the same thing before and after, that will give you information.
Okay, so you could use Bregma or, I mean, glabella or nasion, or if the calipers aren't long enough, even higher than that, but just be consistent in your before and after measures on the same patient. It's the percent change that's going to matter. And, you know, you do good research, you keep good notes. You got to have dates and times of each measure. And if you really want to be able to publish this kind of data in a reputable journal, you need objective oversight. You know, so you need somebody else checking your measures. So you call someone in and ask them to check, and don't tell them what all you did. Just say, please measure this. Yeah. Verify your measurements.
The Children's Hospital here proposed a study to compare the manipulative approach to the plagiocephaly versus the helmet therapy. And I made out a simple proposal to them, sort of into repairs. But I wanted to ask a few questions, like whether the baby had a problem with vomiting or difficulty sucking, those basic questions. They couldn't see why those were important, why they were relevant at all. And then they came up with an immense protocol with all sorts of psychological questions. This thing's never got across off the ground because they needed to have $78,000 grant to do it. Well, you know, it's ridiculous because it can be accomplished with very little financial outlay at all. But so I think we have to do this on our own and confront these people.
So there you have it, our first multi-center trial. Everybody start keeping their data. And when you get more than a couple of cases, you call Dr. Fryman with it and start sending her the data. Don't wait for another meeting like this, because there'll never be another meeting like this with all these people in this room who heard about this idea of starting to tabulate our results before and after treating craniosynostosis or microcephaly.
And when we finalize our
We're not claiming to have addressed craniosynostosis. I'm not convinced that we can change craniosynostosis. The trial was severe lateral strain with a frontal that's anterior on one side and occipital that's anterior on the other, and you've got a lateral strain mechanism.
Those are
the ones that the helmet therapy.
Okay, this is different now. Dr. Fryman is talking about the plagiocephaly group that's getting helmet therapy, this very forceful banding of the head, just like they do with bracing of legs. You kind of casting of legs for kids sometimes.
What calipers are
these? These calipers are any kind of a, doesn't even have to be a medical tool, it could be a carpenter's tool that's used to measure a diameter on something that you can't run a ruler that will go from here to here and tell you gauge on the top of the caliper how long that is.
I got mine as a freebie at the AOA convention.
Okay. Sorry. There are such calipers available that wood turners use to measure the unit for the conformation of bowls and other types of turnings so that they have them symmetrically turned, etc. That are available for up to 12 to 14 inches.
Home Depot or somewhere else?
No, Lee Valley.
www.leevalley.com. Lee Valley, one word?
No, two words.
Two words. Might be one word on the .com thing, though, huh?
Might be.
Now, just to go back to my idea of providing an example of how we would apply technique, apply principles to any part of the body, really. Not applying a technique, we're applying principles that you've learned here this week to other parts of the body. When Dr. Miller talked about treating craniosynostosis, I said, gee, even the bad ones and the ones that are closing fontanelles and ridging, you know, getting ridges on the sutures. And he said, you know, you just have to really get in to every suture in the head, not just the one that the neurosurgeon's interested in, but you have to get in on every suture in the head and V-spread every suture in the head. And then the ones you can't reach across the cranial base, you treat in a way similar to what Dr. Miller showed you with the one parietal in one hand and the thumb on the opposite parietal to handle the whole dural sac around the ball, sweeping down across the anterior and middle cranial fossa. The other hand on the base, handling the opposite condyle of the occiput, the opposite mastoid portion of the temporal bone, right? The opposite side of the splint. That manner of working to work with the sutures across the base through the membranes that envelop those sutures, that envelop the bones and weave between the sutures and sweep over the bones, in the case of the meningeal layer of dura. Okay? Now, let's think about that for a second. It sounds simple enough, V-spread, right? V-spread, 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 maybe a two-handed V-spread. Okay? You'll get a certain amount of result just V-spreading like that across every suture, knowing where sutures are. Okay? What about the different architecture of every suture? Now, let's say you haven't memorized the different architecture of every suture. And let's say you don't have an exploded skull in every treatment room that you work in, that you can kind of cheat, okay? Right? I don't know that that would help you anyway, because every head is different. Let's say you did memorize all that stuff. Even if you memorize the architecture of each suture, where is there overlapping like this, and where does it change to like this, and where does it become overlapping like this? Like the simplest and most accessible sutures, right, across the frontal parietal, right? Coronal suture. Yeah, in one place, the frontals are overlapping the parietals. In another place, the parietals are overlapping the frontals. In another place, they're kind of abutting, interdigitated a little bit. In one place, they're interdigitating a lot. In another place, they're interdigitating a little. So what do you do? You're not going to get the same results if you bespread the whole thing the same way. Okay? You almost have to discover the anatomy under your hands. That's part of your diagnosis. You're not just diagnosing what's wrong and what's stuck. You're diagnosing normal anatomy, the normal anatomy that's there. How do you do that? How would you do that? How would you do that? How would you... Let's get really practical. This isn't theoretical. This is intensely practical. How do you do that? Right. Where would you put your hands? Do we have a skull?
It's like what would you do?
The question is, let's say you have a young child. Usually they're a little older than this by the time they're being diagnosed with cranial synostosis. Say you have a young child whose fontanelles close very early, whose sutures are showing some ridging, who's been diagnosed with cranial synostosis, been to a neurosurgeon who has said, this head may not develop normally if we don't go in and cut out these sutures and, you know, open up some space for development and growth of this head. And the family comes to you and says, we've heard that you're an expert with the cranium and that you have some less invasive approaches. We don't know what you do, but we want to try it. Do you think you can help us? Your answer should always be the same. We never know if we can help you until we try. We have helped people in some situations, and we hope we can help you. How long is it going to take, though? How long is it going to take? That's up to you. You have to say what you're comfortable with, and you say, you know, give it a fair number of visits. A dozen visits, half a dozen visits. What's that, the cost of an MRI? It'll take no more than a few months, 3 months for a dozen visits if you come once a week. And the cost of an MRI or two. They've already spent that. Okay. So, that's your entry to a fair trial for this child to avoid a hellacious surgery that will leave them needing more treatment than they'll ever get in most circumstances. Okay, now, what do? You say, okay, I remember this course where, you know, it was suggested that maybe we could just bespread all of these sutures and do something for this kid. I'm going to do everything I can, but that sounds like a great start. Of course, you treat the whole patient. Of course, you make sure the sacrum is free. Of course, you make sure the thorax and diaphragms are free. Of course, you make sure the whole body is working as a unit to the extent it is capable. And not necessarily in that order. We've tried to get across a little bit about in what order you would do that. That's a little harder to put into words, but that will grow as your skills and experience grow. Just keep aware that the order in which you do things is very important, and the criteria that you use will change throughout your career. Don't get stuck in one way of sequencing what you treat. That sequence will change throughout your career.
as your awareness grows, as your depth of understanding that anatomy grows.
So now you're down to that cranium and those sutures awaiting surgery. What are you going to do? It was suggested to sense which way those sutures move. Let's get specific. Sorry, yes?
Cranial stenosis, what is the status of the sacrum? Is there like a common...
In cranial synostosis, it's a general term referring to earlier than normal closure of fontanelles and joints between cranial bones. Is there one?
Yeah, what was the status of the sacrum? Was the question?
Yeah, the sacrum.
Oh, what's the status of the sacrum? Oh, I thought you said sutures. What's the status of the sacrum in cranial synostosis? Mm-hmm.
If there's like a pattern.
Is it a pattern all over the body? In the half dozen cases I've seen, I didn't notice the same event occurring elsewhere. Dr. Miller?
Haven't made any relationship to that.
Dr. Miller hasn't noticed any relationship either. Which is interesting, which should tell you something about the nature of the problem. If it was what I'm sure the researchers in medicine are seeking to prove, that it's some genetic or other type of abnormality requiring dramatic intervention, you'd see it elsewhere if it was a systemic problem. How would you put your hands on to find out what the bones are doing to dictate what you will do in your V-spread at each location? Let's get specific. I don't mean to bug you. I think you know already.
What I start with is just a vault hold and see what's happening.
Okay. Sorry? She would start with a vault hold and just see what's happening. Okay? You need to see where things are moving more or see where things are moving less? Or both?
Both.
Both. Okay. And then start where?
Well, I think I start where they were moving the best and try to encourage that, and then gradually work toward where they're moving worse. Or if that didn't get me anywhere, then I try to reduce it.
Okay. And get you anywhere where do you want to get?
The whole head moving.
Right. You get that? That's the right answer. Whatever it is you do, whether you start with that which is moving the most, or that which is moving the least, or something in between, you know whether you're starting in the best place when you do some work with that area and you get a response in other parts of the head. So you've got your hands spread out over the whole head, and you're sensing response in the whole unit. And hopefully as you get into this even more, you're sensing response throughout the body to every little thing you do. And this becomes your feedback, your answer to whether you're going in the right direction, you're going in the best direction you could be at that place of treatment. It's good.
Does the faculty kind of have any comments or thoughts about where you may want to start? Because I've heard a lot of things where, like, say if you have something that's really restricted, if you start there, a lot of these muscle restrictions may or may not resolve themselves, you know, and I've heard things from different places, like area of greatest restriction type of stuff, or even just like if the thoracic inlet is unlevel. If you level that out, then a lot of lower cervicals typically take care of themselves. You know, when you hear a lot of that. So is there...
In my experience, the reason you don't hear a lot of that from really experienced practitioners, really senior osteopaths,
is because they have seen that set of priorities change throughout their career. So, for instance, I'll speak for myself. When I was new in practice, if I could find the most stuck place at all, I was doing great. If I could find things that weren't moving in a reasonable amount of time, that was an accomplishment. And to treat that was a great thing. It was the best work I would do. Consistently, I'd get the best treatment results when I approached things that way. A little further on, it was a matter of realizing, gee, you know, the reason that works so well is because a lot of these moving well places are moving extra to compensate for something stuck. Oh, that really reinforced to me that I was doing the right thing in treating the most stuck place to get the best overall response. You know, further, several years further in my limited career here, I started noticing, you know, wrestling with the most stuck place isn't always the most efficient way to work. Sometimes working with a place that's already working, when working with that place gets a response in other stuck places, right? Other distorted places, is a better way to go. Gives a faster result, gives more dramatic changes. Got into a little bit more. And now I'm starting to notice, you know, sometimes it's the one, sometimes it's the other. Sometimes you get your hands on there and you go to work with the motion as it's trying to express change, as it's seeking change, and it doesn't change anything anywhere else. You go to work with the stuck place, sure, you can get it moving, but it doesn't change anything anywhere else. And now it's a matter of looking at the whole body. And trying one or trying the other. You get into a little more, you don't have to try one and try the other. You don't see Dr. Miller motion testing. Well, I'll take it this way, and it works better that way, I'll take it that way. No. He'll put his hands on and immediately be able to sense which way he needs to take it in order to generate the next level of function. Now, that's my interpretation why you won't hear answers to that kind of question, because the answer will be different as your skills evolve. That's my interpretation. Yes?
Dr. Primari noticed that in cranial stenosis, usually the general axial organization is not slowed down or altered that much, changed that much. Could that be like a compensation?
It could be. Sure. The rest of the fascias of the body certainly depend on freedom of motion of the cranial membranes.
And if it's, so if it's a compensation, where do the fascia find the physiological resources for to find this compensation?
All the fascias of the body have the resources to compensate. I don't know if I understood that question. Maybe I didn't understand your question.
So the question was, where do the fascia find the resources to react? On a neuroendocrine level?
Somewhat on a neurologically mediated level, but also with regard to the primary respiratory mechanism level, which is not neurally mediated entirely. Right? We've sensed in many instances things moving in ways that are not neurologically mediated patterns, you know, neuroanatomy, you can distinguish them.
Let's go back to that coronal suture for a moment. You go to V spread the coronal suture, very simple procedure. How much pressure do you use? How much separation force do you use? Do you push the one thumb down and let up on the other because there's a little overlapping? And if you push them both down, you're jamming the suture together, really. You're defeating your purpose. And at what point do you switch the pressure down? I mean, here, where the frontal overlaps a little bit, it's going to be different than here, where the parietal overlaps a little bit. One thumb is going to press down a little more than the other for an optimal result. Now, it's the same answer as your question. Will we be getting into the intraosseous technique? Intraosseous technique is different every time you do it. Same bone, different every time you do it. Every patient, every visit is different. Intraosseous technique depends on the particular pattern of intraosseous strain, the particular pattern of healthy, normal motion moving through that bone from other parts of the body, and within that bone. It's those patterns of motion and those patterns of force which will dictate your technique. That's what this work is all about. We get our guidance from the system. So, you'll have your hands around the coronal suture. And there'll only be one way it opens. With the one thumb a little more down than the other, or the other thumb a little more down than the other. With a certain amount of traction across the suture, be spreading it, or a certain amount less. And it may be more or less at different points in the treatment. You start out with a lot. In a few seconds, you're using less. In a few seconds more, you're using more. And you know about the optimal amount of pressure, force, based on the response in the whole. You sense the response locally because you're always monitoring here, of course. But you're also sensing the response throughout. Okay? Now I want to check my little opinion here about why you don't hear the instruction about what to treat first so much. I'm of that opinion that hasn't changed.
I'd like to make one comment first. Please. Dr. Ronald Becker had in his possession a skull on which there was true fusion of the sagittal suture from the coronal to the lambda. Now, if you would try and motion test that, there was give at the side of the suture, but there was no separation. So it's a matter of evaluating the quality of motion through the area. As to where to start, as I've told you, you put a little attention to the mechanism within that individual. And what you're doing when you do that is asking, what do you need? As you put that into that mechanism, just the light tension, your attention into it, then its response will tell you where you need to go to start. It's not a matter of saying pick A or pick B or pick C and start there. It's a matter of where it directs you. Work. So the more you understand the mechanism, the easier it is to start.
How's that for a short answer? How's that for a short answer?
More than you understand the mechanism.
Now,
you understand. But you can start. I hope
I hope it's as clear to everyone else as it is to me that that answer contained my whole three paragraphs and more. Right? Does everyone see that?
And 40 years of experience.
Well, I'm not embarrassed. Yeah, 40 years of experience. He's not that smart.
Tell him. I wasn't the top of the class.
Yeah, I wasn't top of the class either. I really wasn't. A lot of people, they come up to me in these courses and they say, so much in that, oh, so much in that, oh, too much in that. And I got to tell you, when I first got into this, I just had the same reaction, especially in my first SCTF course. Because I had been studying before that with Ann Wales, with Jim Jallis in New England, and you know, there was a lot of anatomy, but there was then a lot of discussion, and then there was a lot of treating. And then we went to an SCTF course, and I had just finished 3 years of osteopathic school, and I'm at my first really formal SCTF course. Into a lot of little sneak into a weekend here, sneak into a study group there, but not a really formal course. I'm at this 40-hour course, and it's just all anatomy. It's like what we did this in the mornings this week, all day. And at the end of the fourth day, I remember, I went up to Rachel Brooks, who was on the faculty at that course also, and who was younger than the other faculty, so I thought I could get a straight answer. And I said, all of anatomy. Give me a break. Do I really have to know all of this anatomy? Because I didn't know that much. I wasn't that great an anatomy student. At that time, I was a good anatomy student, but I didn't study it more than any other subject. I hadn't yet seen the point. And her answer was really simple, and it motivated me to then really go and study my anatomy. It was only after that point that it was that dinner, in fact, the next night with Dr. Miller, that we had the conversation I related to earlier this week, where he directed me into doing some dissections, and then I really had to get to know my anatomy in order to do the dissections, and I really had to get to know the anatomy in order to show my slides and sound like I knew what was on there. I really studied it. But it was Rachel Brooks who said to me, I can only tell you one thing. Every really skillful osteopath I have met. And at the time, she was on the faculty of the SCTF, so she was there on the faculty where Herbert Miller and Roland Becker and Emma Lay and several others were there teaching, right there. And I know she taught with us, and she said, every single really skillful osteopath I have met knew all that then at one time. They may not have it all at the tip of their tongue, like we do when we have to give a lecture, but they knew it in their hands, and it came from knowing it from the books and from the section and from studying slides and from studying their patients, every single one. That was all the answer I needed. I could see the difference even at that early stage of my career. I could see the difference in these folks who'd been 40 years at this compared to the folks who were teaching us in our clinical office rotations, who may have been 30 or 40 years at this, but they couldn't use their hands. They couldn't use their hands and get results with complex problems the way this senior faculty at the SCTF. That was all the answer I needed.
One comment on that, you know. I thought I knew anatomy when I came out of school. After I'd been in practice for 5 years, I started finding out I didn't have any idea what anatomy was. And after I'd taken about four courses and seminars with the SCTF, started putting together some things. But at the same time, I got it all up here. You know, I can see the picture, I can see the structure, I can see the whole thing and go into it and all. The problem is, my pictures don't have any labels. So anytime in our lecture, I have to go back to review so I get the labels.
Yeah, I think that's why she said, at one time or another. They knew they were in that. And I think I even asked her, I think I even said, even Dr. Fulford? Because Dr. Fulford was famous for, you know, talking about the importance of the anatomy and about how he used it, how they learned it in school and how he used to really have it down. But he was also famous for a little bit acting as if the details of anatomy didn't matter. That's the way it would look on first glance when students would study it. But you know, as I got to know him better, yeah, even Dr. Fulford. And as Rachel Brooks answered me at that time, yes, even Dr. Fulford. I said, even Dr. Becker? Because Dr. Becker was at that time in his 80s, and he was not very articulate about things like anatomy. He didn't give any anatomy lectures that week. I knew he was phenomenal, but I didn't know how much anatomy he knew. So I said, even Dr. Becker? Even Dr. Becker? Yeah, at one time, they knew all that anatomy.
Yeah. Becker would take, I think it was Thursday afternoon, Wednesday or Thursday afternoon, where he'd see no patients. That was his study time. Every week, he got a study afternoon with 4 hours.
4 hours?
Every week.
Study one.
Anatomy, every week to study physiology on one thing or another.
Yeah.
Studying cold.
We should have an anatomy atlas in every bathroom.
What about the moral
question? We're not going to take 4 hours every week, right? Let's be honest. But if every time you brush your teeth and every time you wash your hands, you're looking at this page. Yeah?
It's better.
Wrong with that? What?
In the bathroom?
No, I'm saying. Okay. I don't get that wrong.
I have a question and maybe a suggestion at the same time. Is it possible to take those three-dimensional slides and take them, put them perhaps not in a book, but perhaps on a CD-ROM, and you know, make them so? And the next stage would be maybe. Later on, if technology permits it, to have motion with structures and to see motion with function and distortion of function.
People are working on this now. There are programs now where you wear a certain set of glasses that are wired to the computer, and the glasses, I think what they do is they rapidly switch the computer image from the left eye image to the right eye image, left eye image to the right eye image, and at the same time turn them on and off your left and right eye of your glasses. I think that's the way it works. Then it does, it gives you a 3D image, and those same folks are taking 3D photographs that already exist, loading them into the computer and turning them in space. So you're seeing them from different angles, which is really wild. And then the next step is motion, of course. And that would be animated, right? Until they get some kind of imaging technique where they can image more than just grayscale, right? And show a real person moving. But this is coming. It's definitely coming. It's not here yet. And I think it's a bit cumbersome and expensive to get into the technology of those wired-up glasses and the cost of those programs. So I haven't yet investigated it myself.
But the slides could be publicized because they're invaluable to me. I mean, this course has really brought a different dimension to my palpation, being able to translate those images, like Dr. Franklin said, subconsciously or through, you know, feeling like your hands at the endoscope.
I agree with you. You know, they were published at one time on ViewMaster. So that individuals who didn't want to get into a
couple thousand dollar worth of equipment and silver screens and all the cumbersome stuff, could do it at home with a little viewmaster on these little diskettes, right? The Bassett slides were done exactly that way and made available to the public. But you know, the funniest thing is, they were made available throughout the 1950s, I think, and 60s. And a lot of people got them. They had them even at my school. They were in the anatomy lab, I remember. They were sitting in the back room, and no one went in there and looked at that stuff.
Do you think they will know their anatomy better by having all of this high-tech process? Will they do better than Becker and Sutherland and Steele?
Yeah, good question. There you go. You know, part of what makes it so interesting is that I'm talking you through it, I'm walking you through it, and I'm adding a little bit of life to it, right? To have all of that stuff piled up on your shelf, I don't know if it's so much more valuable. Like Dr. Fern points out, Dr. Sutherland, Dr. Still, Dr. Becker, they didn't have that available. Dr. Becker, I don't even think he did dissections. And I don't think Dr. Sutherland did many dissections. Dr. Still did some dissections. Dr. Sutherland disarticulated his skull. You should all disarticulate a skull sometime in your life. It's easy to do. Yeah, you fill it with beans, you put it in hot water. You don't even have to fill it with beans. You know, we did one with the fellows at Com. We got a big, spaghetti pot. Cut the water boiling. And as soon as it's boiling, you turn it off, because you don't want to boil the bones. You turn it off, you drop the skull in for 45 minutes. It takes 45 minutes in hot, hot water for it to get soft. And it does, it gets pliable, it gets plastic. And we literally pulled the sutures apart by hand. We took the skull apart, we didn't even need the beans.
And when the dental students had learned everything they needed to know about the muscles and the ligaments and all of the soft tissues, he'd take the skull home, and much to his wife's chagrin, he would use a pressure cooker. Oh. He'd cook it for some length of time, and then he'd got a disarticulated skull.
There you go.
You easily get skulls.
You easily get what? Well, this is back when you could get skulls. They're not so easy to get.
Well, yeah, we get them there. There's skulls all over the city.
You can take it from the United. You go to any medical school in the United States, and once they're done with the course, and they're ready to throw away those bones, if they know you, and they know you're not a nut. If they know you and you say you'd like to do further studies on these tissues, they'll be happy to have you in their lab. They might not let you take it home, but I'll tell you, no, in many instances, if they know you're serious and they know you're a scientist, they'll look the other way and let you do whatever you want. Whatever you want. They know that those people who donated their bodies to science were doing it for the furthering of the understanding of human health and disease. And if it helps a physician to take it one step further before they then go throw it into the cremation unit, right? I'll let you do it. You bet. Because it is hard to get skulls. But you know, there are still plenty of skulls around. There are a lot of physicians, retired physicians, who have an old skull laying around and they don't want it, or they have several. And they're willing to part with it. You get one and let that be your disarticulation one. And disarticulate the whole thing, take it apart by hand. It takes a lot of time. You can only do work with it for about, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, and it stiffens up again. You have to then boil the water again. That takes another 10 minutes. Turn it off. You can't leave it on because
it's still connected.
Oh, while you're working, yeah. You've only got a few minutes to work. You got to boil it up again, turn it off, put it back in again. Another 40 minutes. It takes a few days, actually. So you take your time and get through the whole process. Hey, just to feel a few sutures come apart is quite an experience. To feel bones and intraosseous, which they do when they get wet. Wonderful. lot of experience. They learn a lot of anatomy and bad stuff.
Ils arrivent à la maison.
Any other questions? Questions for Dr. Miller? You got one more half a day here with Dr. Miller.
That's
a great question, and I'm going to ask the senior faculty to answer that, but I want to share one thing that they may not have heard. I happen to have a couple of patients who just wrote a book that I should call my office and get the title of, because everybody should read it. It's one of the most rich books I've ever read on parenting. Anyway, they're behaviorists. One's an MD psychiatrist who's just brilliant and understands humanity and understands osteopathy. The other's a early child educator who runs a preschool in Santa Monica. The two of them got together and wrote this book from two different perspectives, an educator and a physician. And the book is about parenting and understanding the child and understanding what a child is going through. And one of the things that this early educator would teach her teachers at the preschool, and I know this because my son went to her preschool, she would teach the children at her preschool, apparently the teachers at her preschool, to encourage the children, the little children, to go through whatever difficult emotional experience they're going through. Let's say, in our case, the difficulty of taking a treatment. They sometimes don't want it. They sometimes cry. They sometimes get scared. They don't understand why the parent isn't rescuing them. And they scream harder, and the parent's just holding their legs still. This can be traumatic in itself. One of the reasons Dr. Freiman asks the parents to leave the room. Now, they would say that the first thing you need to do when that's happening is acknowledge the situation for what it is. Number one, the child is upset. You say that, it's really simple. You're really upset. We understand that you're upset, and we do. We're not making something up. We understand your frustration. We understand you'd rather be doing anything else right now. We understand that this may be scary right now. And you stay with them like that. And you don't even have to have a preset spiel to remember in these situations. You literally describe the situation for what it is so that their mind doesn't spin out of control into some other trauma, like when maybe they got an IV that took 40 minutes to place, or when they got attacked with anesthesia for a surgery, or abused sexually or otherwise. That's where their mind will go. That was the last time they were restrained like this and cried like this without answer. Their mind will click into that. You keep them from clicking into those other traumas. Mm-hmm. Not that there's always the goal to stay away from other traumas, but in this situation, you certainly don't want to reintroduce the horrible terror associated with that. You make it clear that this is different. Yes, we're here for you. Yes, we hear you. Yes, we hear you crying, and it's okay to cry. I can't tell you how many kids stop crying the second I say, it's okay to cry. You're frustrated. You're angry. You're sad about this. It's okay to cry. Like, your mom is here, and she would never let anything bad happen to you. Or your mom brought you here so that you would feel better, and your mom loves you, and we love you. Just tell the truth of the situation.
I guess I'm thinking more like, not if they're crying, am
outwardly upset, but sometimes they're thinking, you know, like if you're touching their sacrum or anywhere, you know, in their pelvis, and they're just like, I've seen my children have a look of confusion, and not like that they're upset and crying, but, you know.
Same thing, you gotta talk them through it. And, you know, not just children. I've had adults. I put my hand under their sacrum after doing an hour-long history and physical exam. Really getting to know them, treating other parts of their body, knowing that this is a loaded area, okay? I go to treat the sacrum, and what are you doing now? I'm wiping your hand there. Now, the fact of the matter is, we use our hands in a very intimate way. There are many people in our culture, in the world, who have never been touched in the way we are touching people, except in sexual intimacy. And if all of their sexual intimacy has not been pleasant in their life, it's going to light up memories of such unpleasantries. When we're touching, now when I say intimate, I don't mean sexual, I mean to put your hands on another human being in the world today in a way that's not probing, like you're trying to get something out of them, right? Or manipulative, to put your hands on in a way that we do, where we're sensing. It's very intimate. And then to interact in that to and fro kind of way that we do. Very intimate. Think about whenever anyone else, it's not like a massage, it's not like anything else, it's not like any other doctor's visit ever was. Yeah, you have to talk them through it at a certain stage.
With a child, I always stop at their feet, on their knees, so they can see and talk to them. We get acquainted. So that by the time I've done everything that they can see me doing, then I will say, now I'm going to look at you upside down. And I put my hands on the head. So now they know what it is that's hitting there. And I find that makes a lot of difference. I wouldn't move in immediately and put hands on the head.
And then the sacrum or pelvis in a sexually abused child?
There again, you move very gently towards it. But again, they can see me. They can see my relationship to them. I can talk to them. And so that we've established a relationship before I'm moving into an area where they can't see me.
That's good. Now, I know that works better for you because seeing you is different from seeing me. I've often said that, you know, the students come to my office and they say, gee, you let the patient stay in your office? Dr. Freiman never lets the parents stay in the office. I've never seen a parent in an office with Dr. Freiman. And I say, okay, now, when the child screams and senior white-haired female Dr. Freiman is in the room, the parents don't think twice about what's going on in the room. I kick the parents out of the room and the child's screaming. The mom's coming through with an axe.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
That's right.
Mother doesn't say that. She says, "Don't be still. Do what the doctor tells you to do." And so that she recognizes the relationship will be a lot better if she will go outside.
That's important, and I'm joking. You know, I'm joking. There are a certain number of parents who have volunteered to leave, and there are a certain number of parents who, once I have established a good relationship with them, I will ask them to leave, and they'll say, gee, great idea.
On many children, when Paul Wolfer was treating them, and they would get into one of these situations where it was difficult for Bob to contact the child himself. My mother put her hands on the child in the area that he wanted to treat and then work through her hands. So if you have that kind of difficulty, it's possible to do it that way. But usually, after you've treated a child a couple of times, you get over this thing, the anxiety. But one of our things in society in the United States is teaching about the potential of sexual abuse in grade schools. It sets up these kids to an extent that is something terrible in relationship to trying to work through their pelvis and so on. So as Viola says, I always start at the feet and work up through. But I recall one day that I had a mother and a child in, and I had treated this child who had a severe plagiocephaly. And we had taken so much of this out of her head and out of the pelvis and everything else. But this day I needed to be in on the inguinal ligaments as I was treating the pelvis. And of course, mother had schooled this child to anybody that was teaching her near the pubic area was abusing her. And I said, mother, until you can teach this child differently, don't you or her come back. Because this is not an attempt in any manner to abuse this child. That was all I could do.
I remember one time an older woman that she, probably around 45, 50. Anyway, when I saw her, I started doing the whole transmission, the whole history, and she lied down. And I started going to the sacrum, put my hand in the sacrum, she said, what are you doing? I pumped in my head. I go, well, I need to work down here. This is an area that I need to work on. Well, I don't want you to work there. And so I was like, well, to be honest, if I can't work there, you might as well not even deal with the situation. You might as well go to someone else. Once you got to her morality, and she was the adult at that time, and she got to morality. She's a female. I'll tell you right now, she'll do the same thing I'm doing. She goes, oh, she will? I mean, yeah. She goes, okay, you can do it then. But she was worried, I mean, you know, that's the situation that you don't know. Hey, I have to treat this, or you might have to just cut it off. I mean, I'm not going to treat you because it's not worth the hassle. I'm not going to get the results I need.
That's a good point to make. Thank you. I've had situations where it turns the corner when I call someone else into the room, whether it's a student who happens to be in the office at the time or one of our staff people. To have a third person in the room makes everything okay. And there are times when you need to do that even if there's not a difficulty. If you have to treat
things.
The scars of the breasts from breast surgeries, if you have to treat ever internally, you should have another person in the room. Absolutely. Same sex or opposite sex. It's just good medical practice. If the patient has a reaction to the treatment that you could never predict, you're going to need help. There are situations. I've got a friend who was an MRI tech. At the time when a patient in the MRI unit got claustrophobic and psychotic, had a psychotic break, never had one before, never had one again. But for the 30 minutes that the two of them were locked in the MRI unit, because she was the tech and there was no one else on the floor, and she went into the room, it was door locked automatically, no one could hear her screaming. It's a soundproof room. And she's being choked. She's permanently disabled. I mean, she broke a clavicle. She was almost killed. And this was a lady who just lost it in the MRI. Now you go to do a, you know, that once in a decade internal treatment of a coccyx that's so severely angulated that you can't come near it externally and you just have to go internally on a person whose coccyx has been like that for a while and maybe who's got a history of sexual abuse that you and they don't know about and you're doing a procedure like that and they lose it, guess what? You're going to need someone else in the room. It can happen.
Emerges the opposite. When you treat the sacrum, they say, do I have a dinner with me?
In the beginning, when cases of behavioral policy in children. It's very common for the children to undergo surgery, to scratch, extend the tendons. And they usually have to take a drug. And I'm not sure about the term in English, but it's botulinic toxin.
Yes, they use it.
And this to facilitate the muscle decontraction. So Dr. Fumari was wondering if there is experience from an osteopathic point of view of some techniques that could help avoid surgery, especially if the CB4 or the NIDR technique would be helpful in that. And if there are also statistical data about outcome in the hospital.
That's a great question. Dr. Freiman says that she'll be talking about that this afternoon when she discusses the treatment of difficult patients. Dr. Freiman has treated many patients like this, cerebral palsy patients who've required surgeries, castings, botulinum injections, and have tried all of the above. And she's helped many of them avoid some of those procedures.
Do we need a brief break, or should we get started?
Oh, we better get started.
Quick break.